Jahan, Reel 6. You were telling me about the requirement for sleep, and I was asking you how you could, how much you needed. And another question is, did you find that as time went on, you got better at doing without sleep and carrying on your duties?
I think so. Mm. I think you did. Yeah. And also, the one person who could sleep would be the operator, the driver, because he could cat nap. And, you know, when he was stationary, he had no other job to do apart from making material packs. That he could have a sleep. But for most of the others, we were on the radio, and the gunner was always, he could probably get a little bit of cat nap as well. But if you're on the radio, you absorb somebody talking or doing something, and you had the.
You can't doze off.
No. Mm-hmm. And we had no system of nobody could take over from me in the choke. Really, because the second command's operator, he was always on back to the colonel.
There weren't enough of you for reliefs or rotations.
No. No. Same with the troop leaders, you see, there was no reserves where they could pull the troop back instead of putting fresh troop in. Mm. There was no sort of planning for that at all.
The only way to do that, really, in a proper way, would have been to have another regiment, wouldn't it?
Yes. If you'd
had another regiment. Yes.
Or if you had a squadron in reserve.
Yes.
But it wasn't possible with the area we had to cover. Mm. And you couldn't sort of send one car back because each vehicle was committed.
So there was no redundancy at all within the regiment.
No.
Yeah. Mm. So you got back east of the dial, you had west of the dial, you had a certain amount of sleep, and then you woke up again. What were you doing after that time then, after that?
Well, from the time we had about 4 hours sleep.
Yes, and then.
And then we were ordered to go down to the
to near Waterloo. Mm.
Right. And then again from that on, we were fully committed.
Yes.
We were in contact closer than we were in the
forward of the dial. Right.
Because when we came down, we were getting the tanks coming up, and each one then would really been hit. We started getting casualties more then.
So you were in contact with the Panzer forces?
That's right, mm. Yes. Each one committed quite a bit, and they lost quite a number of personnel, one or two armed cars.
Mm. What were you supposed to be doing then at that stage when you were deployed around Waterloo?
The enemy coming up more or less from the south.
So they were not coming from the east then, they were coming...
Well, the east was being taken care of by the 1519 from that, those people.
Yes.
And that was those coming up from the south.
So you were screening from the south.
Yeah.
So in effect, you were doing what Wellington had been doing in 1815, or what his cavalry had been doing in 1815.
Yes, in the same area. Because I thought of them at the time. And where's St. Paul's down that way too.
That's much further to the southwest, isn't it? Yes.
Now, what's the order we came from there? Would we have gone up to Arras first?
Well, Arras was about 21st of May, wasn't it?
That's right. Now, what date am I on now? 10th to about 15th.
Mm, yes, yes. Because yeah, if you're in the area around the Waterloo area, yes.
Yeah.
Because, roughly speaking, if you go directly eastwards from Waterloo, you've got the town of Wavre on the dial, haven't you?
Yes.
And then southwards, you're going towards Charleroi and Fleurus and that sort of area, southeastwards.
Yeah, the names, I'm afraid, to me, certain names absolutely to stand out. Evans.
Evans, yes.
You're in that area. That would be about the 20th of May. Well, no, the 20th of May, we moved to Arras. We moved to Arras.
But I mean, so presumably immediately after you'd had your sleep on Waterloo, did you see anything of the enemy while you were on the field at Waterloo? Was that... It was later
no,
on?
No, it was after Waterloo.
So you deployed Waterloo,
yeah.
Looking southward. South. You know, nothing much going on.
Yeah.
And then, presumably you were moved... south from Waterloo area back into France.
Yes, yeah. Sacrifice of Brussels, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes, right. In the evening that day, we were in the area of Waterloo. Swimming us from the armoured cars.
What caused that? Was that the mine? Yes.
The mine, yeah.
Was that mine laid as a defensive measure?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Did you have a lot of mines for that purpose?
Every 6 in an armoured car.
Every armoured car had 6 mines in?
Yeah. They were in a sort of a packet.
Yes.
They had one very great mine, but they would, you know, they blew the wheel off the armoured car anyway.
Wait, I mean, did you normally put out? Did your coal normally put the mines out?
Didn't carry them in Scotland headquarters.
Oh, you didn't? Just
no,
on the,
just
the other troops?
That was at around this time, actually, when we met a lot of refugees. Mm. They started to become a problem if you were trying to withdraw. You got mixed up with them quite well.
What, they just slow you down?
Mm. Yeah.
Was there anything you could do to?
Yeah,
we
nothing you could do.
So you must have been
fighting, carrying all our belongings on trucks, you know, and barrows, horses, carts, whatever.
This must have reduced your rate of movement very considerably.
It did.
So you were going at a walking pace.
Not on all the roads, but in some of the main roads.
Yes.
So if we could get off the road. You know, by using your map, you could probably avoid a lot of
Go on the minor routes.
Right.
Mm. Mm. Do you remember when you first ran into this German armour? Was that before or after the time you were at Arras? Do you recollect?
So, when we went to Arras, there was a tank battle about to go on or happen to the north.
Mm.
We had a job getting through Arras because it was badly bombed. They
bombed yes.
The and we had quite a job to get through.
Mm.
And then, as I say, it was that time when we met up with the bombing and lots of refugees. So then we went down, I think we went to St. Paul or that area.
Mm.
That's when we started meeting the German tanks.
Ah.
I think A Squadron met them at Avens.
Avens, yes.
That's right. Mm. They had three casualties there.
Mm.
And that wasn't until we got into St. Paul, I think it was St. Paul.
St. Paul's your turn was, that
was there a high,
on a hilltop.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, but we got up there, headquarters was up there.
Yeah.
We were down below, and on that road, it's, C Squadron had seen a column of enemy heavy guns, big guns, and they shot them up.
Were these motorised guns or horse drawn?
Yeah. These were motorised.
So they were heavy guns with tractors like
right.
that.
Mm. Mm. They had a load of infantry on motorcycles with them.
Mm.
And they'd shot them up. And the same within a couple of 100 yards, B Squadron, Oscar Pearton, the sergeant, he shot up an anti tank gun and a lot of infantry. He killed them. John Clark Kennedy's one base card was knocked out by an anti-tank gun. John Clark Kennedy went to rescue the crew. He was hit, and he was wounded. He lost that arm of car. At the same time, I came through with a squadron leader, and I was on the guns then, and went up the road, past all these dead. Laying on the side.
These German motorcyclists were
laying back in their side cars. Some were slumped over the wheels, some were laying in the ditches. I've never seen so many dead.
Mm.
And I couldn't bring myself to believe that these were dead bodies. Mm. They looked so unreal. They looked like wax models. You know, it was weird, very weird. And then I went along to their Oscar pavement. Shot all these others. Past John Clark Kennedy's vehicle in the ditch. His driver had been killed. And went past that up the road to where these three tanks were crossing. And the squadron leader told me to open fire on them, and I fired one of the magazine magnum.
With the boys' anti-tank rifle?
With the boys' anti-tank rifle. Could see the ricochets.
Mm. What sort of range was that at?
Oh, 300 or 400 yards.
Mm. So really close.
It's just like being from here to the other side of that field.
Yeah.
And you could see them quite clearly.
Do you know what kind of tanks they were?
They had Mark IIIs. They didn't have a Mark IV then anyway, I think.
Not many of them anyway,
no,
certainly.
They had 75s on them anyway. Mm. I fired at these. I'd stopped on the main road and they were going across the tank.
So they were a crossing target when you opened up on them?
Right to left. Mm. Right.
Yes.
So I fired. And it's funny thing, that morning, Feeney, who was the gunner, Corporal Feeney, he's a Canadian, he picked up a Labrador puppy, that morning, and put it in the old car, which he had set around behind the driver, quite happy. We didn't mind, we didn't see any problems. But as soon as I fired the gun, the noise, still great inside the pit. Mm-hmm. This puppy jumped over the driver's shoulders, onto his lap, and down into the well of the vehicle, you see. And he was trying. When we fired at the tanks, and they started firing back, 75mm, explosions were dropping all around, screamers, turn around. So there he was, trying to turn around with his dog.
A three-point turn,
trying to operate the accelerator, clutch and brake with his dog.
Dog between his knees or with his feet?
Down on the bottom. Mm. It was just like a world like this. That's how you see. And it's all still dropping all around, you see.
Careless talk costs lives.
Careless talk, yeah.
What?
Careless talk.
With the dog. Did he manage to get the car turned around?
Yes, he managed to turn around. And we were coming back down the road, you see. As we passed John Club Kennedy's car in the ditch, the squad leader said, "Get out, trying to get that car and recover it," you see. So I jumped out, and of course, the 75s were still rocking all around, you see. And jumped out, got inside this armoured car, and of course, the driver had been killed.
What had killed him?
Anti-tank gun had gone in.
Oh, I see. There'd been an anti-tank gun on the road as well.
That's right, but knocked the car out. And of course, he was sitting in the car, in the driver's seat, you see, like this. And I had to you could lift the back seat, the rear of the seat up, drop back, and I could lower him back. And then try to sit on his lap to try to get the vehicle out. Of course, I tried to start it, but nothing would happen. I mean, it had been wrecked. So there was no hope. And then next thing I heard was one of the shouting, come on. He was out on the road, and Stevens was pressing the horn, to attract my attention. Come on. And I jumped out, up through the turret, jumped onto the floor, into a ditch, and ran along the ditch. And the car was still moving then, so he'd waved, and of course the shells were still dropping down. And so I ran along in the ditch, and the side door was open, and I think the car was doing 20 miles an hour, and I was doing 25, I think. And I dived in, and my feet were still on the ground as we shot away and got out of range, you see. But the tanks didn't come down and didn't follow us.
Shot you up, and then did they move off, or did they stay where they were?
Well, we couldn't see. Mm. They were still. They certainly didn't come forward to attack us. Mm. So we obviously thought they were going to be
ambushed, perhaps. Mm. Mm. Well, it would have been an uncertain situation, wouldn't it, if they'd gone down a road littered with their own
vehicles.
Down the road was a French armoured car with a bigger van on.
Oh, I see.
But they weren't to know that, and they didn't come up to help.
No. Did you're saying that you were acting as gunner on that day. Where was that? What happened to your
well,
usual gunner?
Well, got off to some reason or another, and probably was at the second command squad. He might have gone. I don't know where he'd gone, but he certainly wasn't there. And of course, the message came over on the air, and the squad leader said, "Right, go." They can't sort of say, "Let's find Feeney." Or, you know, we can't hang around for him wherever he is. It's just that it came on the air. John Clark came here. I've just been hit by an anti-tank gun, and we were off.
What squadron were you in at that time? You were in B squadron. And what were you supposed to be doing around St. Paul? Were you
well, that's
you know what the role was?
Coming up from that direction then. They were going not towards. They weren't coming. Going northeast. They were going northwest.
Right.
And we were on the fringe of it, you see, and that's the address.
So you were really on the southern flank of
that's
the
right.
Dunkirk perimeter.
That's right.
And what were you supposed to be screening or defending?
I think we were a screen.
So just detecting there.
That's right. So we weren't given all the information. You know, we didn't know the big picture. And we just told you go there and you watch out there and what we were doing for. We weren't really told. I think Chalkleys might have been told, but we didn't know, Sam.
Of course, you seem to have been very well informed about the about Plan D going up on the dial.
But only on us, you know, that's where we're going. And when we used to go out on the, when we called forward those three times, we went down to the border, border, so it was obvious that
was the direction.
That's what we were told, you see.
Now you mentioned that there was a French armoured car at St. Paul.
In that area,
yes, in the area. Were there any other Allied troops in the town when you were there?
Didn't see. I think Gort's headquarters was somewhere near there too.
Well, GHQ was normally at Kassel, which is further north, actually, in Belgium.
It was in the centre of the town, where, close to where we were, not far from St. Paul. It had a chateau on the hill. That's what it was near St. Paul.
From what you've been saying, it seems that you were you moved up, you were in contact with the enemy for perhaps 2 days or so on the area in the east of the dial. Then you were mainly involved in moving until you had a next encounter
observing.
And I mean,
had you not a lot of action, not a lot of incidents.
But I mean, did you see a lot of enemy troops on, you know, in between crossing the Darn and getting to the St. Paul area? Had you observed a lot of enemy movement?
Yes, I think there was still, you saw the odd advancing coming through. But it wasn't until we got to the bridge that could stop and then sort of build up a picture and send back a picture.
But you hadn't actually been engaged in between those two times. Yeah, but B squadron, you were able to get out of the way, bug out before you actually got into contact. And when you saw the Germans coming forward, you were saying that in the first encounters with the Germans, they weren't really moving in a very tactical way.
No.
They were just coming down the road in a rather incautiously, and you were able to shoot them up.
That's right.
What about later on when you saw more of them? Did they?
They still seemed to come up onto the objective, still expecting to drive straight over a bridge. They probably didn't know what had happened, or their communication might not have been all that great.
So you didn't, I mean, they didn't move in the same way that we would have moved when they were advancing to contact.
No, I think had it been us, we'd have had one car go forward, that might have got shot out.
Yeah.
Then we would have said, right, we'd have taken something, well, you want to set up a load of motorcyclists or infantry just open. Because sometimes you could see a big column of vehicles coming in certain places.
Mm. Just moving en masse.
That's right. Mm. Mm. And of course, they had all their people with them who would, probably engineers who could cross the river with a pontoon, and they had that all with them, I think, probably.
Mm.
And also the heavy guns that were shot up by C Squadron.
Yes, what were they doing in a forward area
I think whether that got lost or, we're going up north, northwest. And didn't expect to see our troops where they were, you see.
Mm.
It had been a screen. And that might have been the tail end of somewhere, and the tanks and that might have been further.
You mean they got intermingled with us, then?
Probably. Mm. Mm.
It does sound as though they weren't really so keen upon the idea of recce-ing and screening as we were.
No, they just went along on the mass, I think.
Mm. Mm. What happened then after the encounters at St. Paul?
I think all along that side at the time, both squadrons were pretty well engaged. I should say, A squadron were pretty heavily engaged in that area by tanks. We then went up from St. Paul, so then went up towards Ypres and the Menin Gate. We were on the Menin Gate we spent the night in Ypres, and this town was completely deserted. All the shops were, just the doors were open, not a soul about. And we stayed there overnight.
In the town itself, in the town centre?
Mm. Mm. Right on the Menin Gate, actually.
Mm.
I know that my enclave was there, and there was an anti-tank on this side of the gate, and the town was behind us. And we were there overnight. And then when we left the anti-tank gun and went off somewhere else.
Do you know who owned the anti-tank gun?
Somebody did tell me. It had been a Yeomanry.
Might have been, some of the Yeomanry regiments had been converted to anti-tank between the wars.
It might have been a Yeomanry.
Mm. But it was just the one gun on its own.
Mm. Well, that's all I saw.
Yeah, there might have been others then in the town.
I think that I got a picture somewhere of that anti-tank gun. You could see a armored car on the other side of the road there.
So, I mean, was this a sort of, were you deployed tactically at Ypres, or were you just having an overnight stop?
No. That was, we were there to defend it.
You were covering the Menin Road.
That's right. And that's when we saw a lot of the transport, far side of it, coming down.
What, along the ridge, the east of Ypres?
Yeah.
Because there are two ridges, aren't there, that go up towards Passchendaele in that area, and they're successively laid out in front of us.
There was just this one ridge where we could see lots of transport.
Well, enemy transport.
Yes.
Too far away to engage.
Yes, yeah. But we knew they were coming down too.
And were you able to report that back?
Oh, yes. Any movement we saw was reported back. But it happened, everything was so quick. Time that message got back, and probably
out of date.
Out of date. The movement was so fast.
Sounds like you were really being rushed off your feet.
All the time, we were just rolling here, there, sort of dashing from 30 miles from one place to another, and then off. It was no chance to rest. It was all quick movement. Because they were moving so fast. If you just stayed where you were, you'd be cut off as well.
Had anything you've done in training or in exercises you prepared for that sort of
really.
Pressure of
not
events?
Speed. Not
no.
Speed.
And was it the speed itself that really
made us die? Mm. Yes, because you had no chance to. You were doing a lot of moping.
Mm.
And while you were moping, you couldn't see. You had to be on the air or map reading or whatever.
So you had no chance to rest or stop and work out what was happening.
Yeah. Mm. And I'll say, we weren't kept informed as they are now. I mean, the thing is, with the troop now, you make sure every member of your crew know what's happened, but they didn't in those days.
Do you think it would have helped if you had known what was going on?
Well, I don't think so. Mm. I mean, the troop leader was had his thing, and we just acted on his orders. And how we shot or how we operated, it made no difference to the big picture. I mean, we were there; we just did what we were to see. If we saw a target, we'd shoot at it. Whatever.
You might be able to argue that it would have been rather more worrying if you had known the big picture.
Well, how would it have
been? You know, since things were not going well at the time, and then the army was in full retreat to the channel.
We had a good idea that we weren't
advancing.
Advancing.
I bet you did.
And then gradually, as you were coming through these times, you were being bombed a lot. Yeah, when you come through, as you were coming through a town, there'd be a super wave, and you'd get about 18 supers would be coming down, and you'd get through the town as fast as you could, or whatever.
Did B Squadron suffer at all from Stuka attacks?
No. Well, we were in the raids.
Yes.
But we weren't.
You weren't hit.
Had no casualties. Mm.
Lots of people who went under Stuka raid said that the main effect of the Stuka raid was really psychological rather than physical. It was simply the
terribly frightening.
Yes, exactly.
The
noise was an overwhelming feature of the Stuka raid.
I don't know if they had it in France, but certainly on the desert, they used to attach sirens to the plane as it died, and then the scream of the bomb. And they all seemed to come in 18s. And it used to be frightening, and they used to come down, and especially if you were just 300 cars, and they came down on you, you know jolly well. And now at times I had my rear wheel in a bomb hole, been that close. And it used to happen on the desert. Every day we were bombed, and we started getting very bomb happy. And in fact, at one stage, my gunner, whenever he heard an aeroplane, after we'd had, you know, had about a month of this, he'd get out of the armoured car and he'd run a mile to get away from the armoured car because he knew that's the target. And no, that wasn't, he wasn't a coward. You know, he'd had so much of it.
He'd had more than enough.
He'd had more than enough. Mm. And he just hit. Mm. You know, in the First World War, he'd probably been shot.
Certain times he would have been, yes.
No, there's nothing wrong with that time. So we were sending back Kyle, and he recovered. The next thing I knew, he joined the parachuters, and he was in the army. So I tried, you know, of course, that man's not a coward because he's on his way, it's just that thing to do.
Well, some people are more vulnerable to certain pressures than others. Did you notice them having the siren when you were in Belgium, though?
I didn't notice it so much, but I was certainly in. I think in Belgium, I didn't feel that I was the target necessarily. The town was the target.
Yeah, you just happened to be there.
Yeah, but on the desert, you knew you were the target.
And you had six troopers each coming after you.
And they were coming down, so you knew you were the target. And that was the final part. And I got to the stage just after Webb. Gone back, and we were like this. And I was getting very, very jumpy. And we were coming back from the Suisse, so we were going back to the 5th, and 18 Stukas came over. We were having a conference in the back of the three tunnel, in someone's shack as spookers. And everybody jumped out, and we had some slip trenches dotted around, which, you know, you could jump into. So we were basically in a vehicle area type thing,
all
over the slip trenches. You know. And everybody jumped out, and they could jump into the slip trench. Now, I knew if I'd have jumped in that slip trench, I'd been finished, you know,